From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
Listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this rather cool Monday morning. Hope that you are doing very, very well out there and are having a great start to your week. We hope to make a great start to your radio listening week as well. As we always do on a Monday later on, we are going to be going down to Parliament. Parliament has now opened, so we're going to be going to our parliamentary correspondent, Rob Hutchinson from Dear South Africa, to find out what is going on in Parliament. So that is later on. We've also got a special 9 days track for you, which we will be explaining a little bit later on. But of course, you can't get away from what is going on in the Middle East at the moment and the continuing issues regarding the hostages and regarding all sorts of other aspects of the fight with Iran and with Hamas and Hezbollah. And we decided what we would do is actually bring in some people who are doing something about that and look and see what is going on with regards to how people are making a difference. So we have in studio and online a team that is dealing with the victims of October 7th and trying to handle from a legal aspect some of the issues that they are facing now in the aftermath of that tragedy, which has, of course, defined Jewish existence now for 9 or 10 months. And the team is from October 7th, Justice Without Borders. And in studio, we have Mahalia Schoenwald-Moss, and she is the lead advancement officer for the organization. Mahalia, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Benji. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And we will also be bringing in from Israel in a few moments the person who's doing the legal side, but we'll introduce her in a bit. Mahalia, let's just start off with what the organization is and how you actually got involved, because legal lawfare is not your particular specific specialty, or not until now anyway. But you are involved anyway. So give us a bit of your background and how you came to be involved with this initiative.
Sure. Thanks, Benji. So it's been 303 days since October 7th. I think October 7th was a day that changed history irrevocably. For me personally, my whole family lives in Israel. I'm Israeli. We were definitely caught off guard on that day. And it was a very soul-destroying day for all of us, whether we have family in Israel or not, I think for the Jewish people globally. And on a personal note, my niece was actually on Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th, and she miraculously survived the massacre. So I have definitely a deep personal connection to the kibbutz. I also have other friends who are from Kibbutz Be'eri, and you know, the events of that day completely had me very clear that I needed to do something. I needed to contribute, I needed to help. And my background is in capacity building, business development, fundraising and development, and not-for-profit management. And Yael Viask-Viersman, who's the founder and lead attorney of the October 7th Justice Without Borders Initiative, we've been friends for many years. And when I found out what she was doing, I immediately reached out and asked her to get involved.
Okay, so that we've got an introduction. We're going to be speaking to Yael in a moment. You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review, and we're talking getting justice today for the victims of October 7th. And the organization that we're chatting to is October 7th Justice Without Borders. And we've already met our local connection here, Mahalia. But we are also crossing over to Israel now to chat to the founder of the initiative, Yael Vias Gvisman, who is a lawyer. And someone with a very strong background in gender-based violence and legal issues. Yael, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us on Chai FM.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Now, before we get into the actual project itself, give us a bit of your background as a lawyer. Where is your interests lie and your specific specialities?
Yes, so I'm a lawyer specializing in international law, specifically in international criminal law, so genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And I've been working on these issues in mass atrocity for the past 20 years in totally different situations, whether related to Darfur, Sudan, genocide, or the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ukraine, and other situations. I've been wearing the hat of a prosecutor, defense, and representative of victims of international crimes. The sole difference is that on October 7th, I woke up with my family in Tel Aviv, and since then, I've been doing what I have been doing for the past 20 years, but at home. That's the main difference.
So I think that's a really great introduction, and it gives us a real perspective on what the organization is about. Let's start with this. I mean, lawfare and legal NGOs in Israel are not a new phenomenon. There's a number of them that do particular work. Can you maybe explain to us why this is different? How does this do what other NGOs are not doing, or what the state, for example, is not doing to help these victims?
Sure. So first, I'd like to emphasize, you said lawfare and other NGOs. So definitely the legal front or the law is definitely recognized as a tool. You know, it's a fact for many years, whether in regulating state relationships or other, you know, other scenes. So international law is there to remind us of the fundamental values, the core values that unite all of us, no matter the politics. That's what it's supposed to be. Now, the uniqueness of October 7 Justice Without Borders is, first of all, the fact that we're representing victims directly and individually by power of attorney. So it's not a collective initiative. It's for the sake of individual victims. The second thing is that we've built and we've orchestrated strategic litigation for the victims so that they have effective remedies in their rights internationally recognized as the right to truth, the right to recognition, the right to justice, the right to reparations, and the right to non-repetition, you know, never again, right? So ever since Nuremberg, this is the Nuremberg legacy for the October trials that we want to see coming into effect. So the real uniqueness is that we're victim-centered. We're representing today 300 victims from 11 different crime bases in Israel. And we've tailored a strategic litigation. We're not doing just a pick and choose. We're leading a legal front both internationally, domestically, and in third states, whether in criminal proceedings or in civil lawsuits. Where each model, you know, the civil and the civil, have different advantages and disadvantages, and they actually complete each other. So they're interactive, and each of them has their importance and their objectives and strengths.
Now, of course, if someone has either been involved with some local legal issue in a country like South Africa or anywhere else in the world, or even if you've just watched a legal program on the television, you'll know that if the person loses a trial, they go to jail or something like that. So, what is it, you talk about effective remedies? What does that look like when you on the one hand, dealing with international law and states and third-party states, as you're talking about, but at the same time, dealing with individual victims. What does that look like, I guess, success or remedy for the victims here from this perspective?
Right. So what it actually comes down to is really a test case for everything we call universal values, international law, human rights. You know, this is the test case, because once we have a direct victim whose life has been utterly shattered since October 7, I mean, the lives of so many, and we're talking about tens of thousands of individuals, even hundreds of thousands of internally displaced individuals since October 7. So these are lives shattered. And what we want to see when we talk about effective remedy is actually several things. So we're talking about first the recognition of the truth. We want a truth, a fact-finding, sort of reliable fact-finding investigations, and we're taking an active part in these fact-finding initiatives, either directly in the field or with authorities, Israeli authorities, or in cooperation with worthy civil initiatives. We're talking about recognition by courts of the truth. You know, this is we've ever since October 7, we've seen so much destruction on the Israeli and also in Gaza. We can't ignore that. There's utter destruction everywhere. From the day that Hamas and their accomplices chose war, chose bloodshed, they've opened the door to hell, really. And so what we want is a stop to all this. We want recognition. We want justice through the highest legal standards. We don't want, executions and so forth. We want the Nuremberg trials. We want the Eichmann trial for these individuals who bear a responsibility. So we want accountability for these atrocity crimes. We want an end to impunity. We want everywhere in the world, everywhere in the free world to recognize I'm talking about the free world, so I'm talking about democracies where the rule of law is most significant. And this is why the legal front is such an important, I won't say weapon, right, but it is such an important tool in order to bring to effect victims' rights. So the fact the victims can have standing in courts, they can voice their story, the fact that they gave me power of attorney, I can bring tangible evidence of atrocities, whether it's extermination, murder, torture, sexual and gender-based crimes, or other atrocity crimes. So this is what we're talking about. The criminal investigations and prosecutions, they take time. So do the civil lawsuits. We push forward only based on sort of our discretion, based on legal perspectives, legal sort of considerations. We're non-political, and we're doing this, really in the name of humanity, because on the 7th of October, something was broken. And I truly believe that law has a role to play in fixing it.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review, and we're talking getting justice for victims of October 7th. If you want to ask any questions of our guest, 34519 is the SMS line, and you're more than welcome to send that in to get your perspective. Stay tuned. This is the New Blue Review on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM, talking about international justice today with October 7th, Justice Without Borders. We've got Mahalia Skolnik-Moss in studio with us, and from Israel, Yael Weiss-Grisman, talking about the work that they're doing. Mahalia, let me just bring you in here. Obviously, Yael is very much on the front line doing this very important work and doing the gathering. You're here in South Africa. What is your role in helping to empower Yael to do this kind of engagement?
Sure. Thanks, Benji. When it comes to building capacity for our work, my role is to engage the larger communities that have influence to help us. That includes media connections. It includes funders who want to assist us fiscally in scaling. You know, we plan to be able to increase our capacity to represent 2,500 victims of October 7th in the next 6 months. That's going to take a scaling of all our different divisions. One is legal. The second is our research team and our forensic specialists who collect evidence. And the other is, our network of influence. And that's really what I'm focused on from South Africa.
Really, really important. Yael, let me ask you about that part of what Makhali was talking about, which is the forensic side. That has become a battle zone in and of itself, actually, since October 7th. I mean, you're talking about the legal side, but really the forensics of what's happened has become, I don't want to call it a debate, but it's almost as though there's certain parties who just want to prove that this didn't happen, even though it was filmed and all of that kind of thing. So tell us about where you guys come into that side of engaging with the forensics.
Well, it's true. It's absolutely right that the standard, it seems at least, that the standard of proof is much higher, elevated and demanding in this case of atrocity, where actually individuals working in the field of atrocity for many years, they recognize sort of signs. It doesn't mean that we're convinced that specific crimes were committed just by these signs, but there is a certain pattern that we recognize. And we are analytical and we are critical about everything we deal with. So it is true that Israeli authorities in the first days, the first responders and so forth, the citizens who were also in the front line, their first sort of priority was not forensics. It wasn't what they had in mind. Wasn't, oh, let's prepare this sort of blood pool for the criminal and the civil proceedings that will take place soon. What they were having in mind is first combat, securing the area. There were actually people killed in the kibbutzes. There was a story of an individual, a farmer in Kisufim, who returned on the third day to give water to the cows. They would have died. These are his cows. He's responsible for them. He went there just to give them water, and he was shot by a terrorist, shot to death, unfortunately, after he had survived the 7th of October attack. So the first priority was really combat. It was much of the southern part of Israel was really conquered by armed, non-state armed groups, so militias, Palestinian militias, and that was the very first priority, securing the area so there was combat. The second priority was the fact that there were 3,200 missing persons in the very first days. 3,200 missing persons. So just think of their families not knowing if their loved ones were dead or alive. And alive usually meant hostage. And these were if it's possible to say, these were the good news, because other families received the the tragic news that their loved ones were killed on the 7th of October. So the second priority really of authorities was there were committees that were established, committees for the missing persons, and identifying by the little that was left sometimes, DNA or other forensics. So the fact is some forensics actually do exist. Even a lot of forensics do does exist. The work that was done here was tremendous. It was simply not it wasn't focused on any criminal proceedings like it would have been the case in a simple crime scene. For example, a common law murder where three were killed, maybe, over a fight. That would have called for an immediate different response of, for example, the investigative police coming to the scene. So what we had here were first responders who did not have the qualifications for a criminal arrest, a criminal investigation. However, there was a committee from the very first days that included investigative police, that included forensic doctors and so forth. So all of the material is there. A lot of it is under seal right now because we're still in operation. There's still combat. So There are still living hostages. There's still information out there that could endanger their lives. And so all of the forensics mainly have gone from, let's say, the health minister to the defense minister, let's call it that. And so a lot of it is under seal for operation reasons. Other things are under seal because the investigation is still ongoing in Israel. And until a decision is taken either to issue arrest warrants or to close a case. In any case, all of this information belongs to the victims. So victims have the right to know what has happened to their loved ones. And authorities agree with us. So we are in agreement. We are in contact with the doctors and the investigators who have been dealing with these this massive amount of information from the very first days. And it's all preserved and collected. Our job is really to assist authorities when the timing is right, to channel this information to the criminal proceedings, to proceedings of accountability. And in the meantime, we're on the ground going to 28 different crime bases. This is really ant work that we're doing. We're going to kibbutzes. We are looking at satellite photos. We're looking at the houses. What was there on the October 6th? What was there on October 7th? And what is there now? And this is the way to map in a very sort of serene way, a bit disconnected from reality, because our reality is burning. There's nothing serene around us. Even as we speak today, we're on very high alert from the threat of an Iranian, an Iranian attack and then so forth. So all of this is going in the background, and we're persevering. We're persevering very meticulously. We have protocols on how to proceed. And we're bringing in our expertise, but not only our expertise, but also our partners' expertise. So, for example, we signed an exclusive cooperation with We Are Not Weapons of War, who are experts based. It's an association based in France, and they've been operative in, some of their staff has been operative in over 90 cases of sexual and gender-based violence and other atrocities and so forth. So we have partnerships. I bring also a network of what amazing individuals who I've been working with throughout these past 20 years. And there really is a joint effort for the revelation of the truth. And it's not just the truth, so that it goes on Twitter the next day. It's truth so that it goes into courts, following, due process, the right to fair trials of the defense as well, of the prosecution, but most of all of the victims.
Now, let's just talk about that international system for a moment. In some ways, Israel obviously is part of the international system, but also has a bit of a difficult history with it. Not necessarily on the legal side, maybe just more in some of the multilateral forums. But certainly since October 7th, we've seen interventions by the ICJ, both an advisory level and at the state level. We've also seen referrals to the ICC. So I guess what I'm asking is, given this kind of activism that's happening outside of what you are doing, does this affect the work that you're doing trying to get justice out of these organs, which are also being used in other ways at the same time?
Thank you for raising this issue. Actually, it also relates to your previous question on why we're doing something that the state cannot do. So the thing is that we're bringing our professional expertise for the service of victims. And this is an extraordinary force, really. It's a strength, because who is more legitimate to demand justice than the victims themselves, direct victims? The state cannot represent victims. It can represent the state, or it can hold trials themselves, investigations, and hold individuals accountable. The only ones that can represent victims are really experienced lawyers, attorneys, who are specialized both in international law and in the different jurisdictions that we work in. So this whole scene, we're representing victims directly at the International Criminal Court based at The Hague. We're actually the first to have filed a complaint to the prosecutor of the ICC as early as 31st of October. So the first complaint ever filed for the victims of October 7, we're the ones who filed them. We constituted our official nomination or official standing as victim representative as early as 15th of October. At the time, I was representing 10 or 11 families of missing and hostages, missing persons and hostages, who also included survivors and included also those murdered. So it is definitely a must that victims' voices are heard on the international scene. If we were not there, all there would be these state-to-state proceedings. So what you have mentioned correctly, the ICJ between states, the South African petition against Israel based on the Genocide Convention. Israel is you're right. It's there is sort of this difficult situation there. There is a complex situation. We have to remember that Israel is not only part of the international system. It's also one of the authors. It's one of the architects of the international system post Second World War and, you know, the United Nations Charter, the International Court of Justice, and the International Criminal Court. So an international court, an independent one, and a permanent one, whose mandate is to say never again, exactly for these crimes that we're talking about, October 7 justice.
Now, you're speaking about victims, and that's a that's obviously one element of what you're focused on. But at the same time, you're also speaking about hostages, and there's an ongoing movement in Israel to get the hostages out. Sometimes, you know, sometimes not always at complete agreement with how the state is operating the negotiations. We see this kind of debate all the time. And I'm interested in what way does this legal element that you're pursuing assist the hostages and potentially assist in getting them out, which I think everybody would like to see as soon as possible?
Yes. So another complexity we're functioning in is, of course, the situation here on the ground. There's a political situation. There's a civil unrest. There's a lot of tensions, and there is the need to save lives. So what we're leading is the legal front. We're not taking part in negotiations or anything like that. We're actually leading a very clear-cut voice that the law offers us, which names the facts as they are, which is taking hostages, keeping persons under enforced enforced detention or enforced forcibly taking persons from their homes, from their beds, and keeping them captive, that is a crime against humanity, and that bears no room for negotiation. So, of course, we support negotiations. We support saving lives by any way. That is our, you know, our spirit. However, our role is to, in parallel, speak up, you know, call the things as they are, which is the obligation of the Hamas and, you know, the Palestinian militias is to, first of all, not have taken these individuals, not have put their hands on them ever. Now that they have, then to release them immediately and unconditionally. This includes the living hostages and, unfortunately, also those who were killed. Their bodies were taken on the 7th of October, but also those who were killed in captivity, under Hamas captivity or other Palestinian militias. So our voice is a clear-cut one. No matter how you call it, what we're talking about are crimes against humanity and war crimes. This includes also the soldiers. Once they are killed or once they are taken captive, they are hors de combat, meaning they are not taking an active part in hostilities. They deserve POW status, so prisoners of war status. They have to be held secure. I mean, nothing very different from the situation today. So our voice is clear cut. We're talking about crimes against humanity and war crimes. They have to be immediately and unconditionally released. That cannot be negotiated. That's a fact. And the fact that our reality calls on us these, you know, very difficult dilemmas and calls on us to negotiate and to do anything in our power to save lives, that is also a fact. That is our reality. However, the hostage taking, it actually, on a legal front, it's the only continuous crime. So all of the crimes were, that's a second element I wanted to mention, is that the hostage taking is the only crime that is a continuous crime. Other crimes that were committed on October 7th or around October 7th, hostage taking is continuing till today, so past 300 days. Not only the captivity of these hostages, but also their treatments, torture that they are facing, sexual and gender-based violence that they're facing. And we have UN officials, UN special rapporteurs who have recognized this fact, this reality.
Now, we've spoken about the international system. We've spoken about states and the individuals. You sort of mentioned Hamas and the non-state actors who kind of, in some respects, fall outside of the system a little bit. But they are actors inside the system that are not state-based, like UNRWA and groups like that. Do you look into how they can be held accountable for whatever complicity they have had engaged in this?
Definitely. We expect from each actor, no matter their identity, and especially if their mandate is based on humanitarian principles, we expect every actor to act, first of all, according to the law, to protect and to maintain and to respect basic human rights, definitely not to take part in crimes, definitely not to take part in systematic and or widespread attacks against the civilian population. We have filed, along with our American partners, a lawsuit against UNRWA. Now, a lawsuit against UNRWA could be perceived as a political action. We filed it only because we are convinced that this lawsuit is founded by fact. It's also founded by calls from the UN from 2014 and 2015 to UNRWA officials and to UNRWA to take care of what's going on in their premises and so forth. The fact that every UNRWA school, there is no UNRWA school in Gaza that is not being totally controlled by Hamas for combat. The fact that there is not even an exception, and even if you find an exception, would be really the exception to the principle. And that UNRWA, instead of calling help to the UN and the international community, is actually fostering this activity. There is an accountability there. And I say this with a heavy heart. This lawsuit was not filed lightly. It took a lot of work from us and from our American colleagues, our partners. We're part of this lawsuit between out of 101 plaintiffs, we're representing 29 of them. And we're also actively in charge of a very acute legal question that will determine the success of this lawsuit, which is the functional immunity that UN officials benefit from, just like heads of state. And our premises are that international crimes cannot, that functional immunity cannot be a shield from the commission or the accomplice in the complicity in crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. And we're basing this on hundreds and hundreds of case law, starting from the Pinochet case in the 90s.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review, and we're talking getting justice today for the victims of October 7th.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. We've been talking today to October 7th Justice Without Borders with Mihalia Skowald-Moss and Yael Vias-Grisman, and finding out about how they are working legally to bring the perpetrators of October 7th to justice. Mihalia, if people want to contribute, want to support, how can they go about doing that with this project?
Thanks, Benji. So just to reiterate that October 7th, Justice Without Borders, we are a pro bono legal initiative leading this unique front for justice, and we need your financial support. Please reach out to me directly. It's mihalia@gmail.com. So it's mihalya@gmail.com. Alternatively, you can connect with us via LinkedIn, social media like Facebook, and visiting our website, October7thJustice.org. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me and can't, please reach out to Chai FM.
Thank you so much, Mahalia. Thank you so much, Yael. Amazing work that you're doing. It's really appreciated, not just actually by the victims, but I think on behalf of the whole Jewish world, whatever tools we can get to get accountability, we should take them. And having people with such expertise as yourself, I think, really is a huge benefit and a really important tool to dealing with this particular situation. So thank you. Best of luck and stay safe with all your work that you're doing.
Thanks, Benji.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There we go. That is the team from October 7th, Justice Without Borders.